Welcome to the Against the Stream Nashville podcast. We're very excited to announce that we are changing our name to Wild Heart Meditation Center. You can stay subscribed to the podcast as you currently are, or if you choose to join us again at a later date in the future, just remember to search wherever you get your podcasts for Wild Heart Meditation Center. We're excited to be introducing new facilitators to our group and expanding our presence in our local community. Enjoy. So as always, the invitation in listening to this part of the group, the Dharma Talk, is just an opportunity to connect with your own personal history and experience and to listen into a way that, you know, invites you to kind of explore what resonates for you and to notice that. So almost, you know, the Dharma Talk is really an opportunity to practice mindfulness. You know, to see, as the Buddha says, what leads to your welfare and happiness. Because these truths are self-evident, right? These truths are things that we've experienced in our own lives. They're not dogmas or systems of belief that are being asked or requested of us, but rather things that we want to explore. And we're going to continue to explore the topic or the theme of gratitude tonight, which I started talking about last week, which is really an extension of a series of talks I've been giving on the theme of intention, living with intention. You know, how to live with more intentionality in our day-to-day life. And one way I like to describe this is just to bring more awareness to what we're doing while we're doing it, and to actively participate in living within the scope of our values. And that's a whole life of practice right there. Just mindfulness is just bringing this attention or awareness into the present experience, into what we're doing while we're doing it. And looking at, you know, the motivations, the underlying movements of the mind, and are the movements of the mind in line with our values? A lot of times they aren't. And that's okay, right? But we can bear witness, we can watch. And so the Buddha's emphasis on meditation is really training two things: wise attention and wise intention. And you don't really separate these two things out. They work together. Wise attention, it just means that we're able to watch and see what our attention gets caught up in throughout the day, right? A couple weeks ago, I talked about a Harvard psychology study that says we have between 50 to 70,000 thoughts in a day. I call it the thought stream. And the attention, the attention is this mental faculty that gets picked up by the thought stream and carried downstream. And so our minds wander into a lot of, you know, future and past, and a lot of comparing and a lot of fantasy and a lot of different neighborhoods. And we want to go with it. We want to babysit the mind. So that's wise attention. It's just being really kind of careful or full of care with tending to the mind and where it goes. And then wise intention means that we're also training to have a compassionate and kind attitude to the mind. So we're actually trying to nurture and care for the mind. And a couple weeks ago, when I talked about intention, I talked about three functions of intention, three ways that it operates. One is intention is moment-to-moment decision-making. So that means we look at our intentions, or really I would call it our motivations behind what we're doing in the moment. That's a big part of practicing mindfulness, is just so we have more access to attention and our intentions in the moment. We can see where our attention is, and we can see how we want to relate to what we're experiencing. Another function of intention is determination. And determination just means, like, when we have a goal, and we're determined to apply it and commit to it. That's a big part of spiritual practice. That's why we're in this room together, is because in a way, you know, we kind of all convene and talk about this common interest that we have in our personal welfare and the welfare of others, and how do we commit to that? Because we all want to do good, right? But why don't we? Well, we just lose sight of it, that's all. It's not because we're immoral. You know, it's not because human beings are inherently bad or greedy, or, you know, it's because we have a survival system that is wired to survive instead of thrive in relationship and thrive in other aspects of life. And so we have to be determined, and we have to have kind of a goal and some accountability, and that's one way that we use intention. The third is living with intention means living within some principles, ethics. And so, you know, these are, you could call them spiritual principles that Buddhism offers. There are really three primary ones that the Buddha talked about. One is the principle of renunciation, which is just the ethical commitment to live with more simplicity in trying to, you know, live with less clutter and less preoccupation with more, right? We are a big culture of more. We like to have more whatever, bigger cars and, you know, bigger houses and more stuff and more relationships with more people and so on and so forth. And that there's a benefit in having things. The Buddha wasn't against things, but looking at our relationship to things and understanding that it's maybe easier to navigate when we live with more simplicity, when we kind of can practice not needing anything extra. We also can practice the intention of compassion and goodwill. These are aims of our intention. So if determination keeps us here, if mindfulness helps us with moment-to-moment decision-making, what are we aiming our decision-making? We're aiming our decision-making with the intention to live, you know, with some simplicity, to not kind of overcomplicate or get caught in the excessive stories of the mind, to be able to live with compassion and with goodwill in mind. So these principles are fundamental for any spiritual practice. You find them in any humanist philosophy. You find them in any religion or spiritual tradition. They're things that I think we collectively value. And last week, I added the practice of gratitude to this, which I didn't add. The Buddha talked a lot about gratitude and developing the principle, the practice, really, of practicing gratitude in our lives. I talked a lot about the neuroscience research behind gratitude, mostly because I find it fascinating, because there's a lot of research, maybe even more research on gratitude than there is mindfulness itself, although these days I don't know. But in general, you know, mental training like meditation or, you know, things like cognitive behavioral therapy, where you're really looking at your cognitive thought process, we know that by doing things like this, we can restructure the neural pathways in our brain, right? They say neurons that fire together wire together. And some of our most ancient systems of brain activity are wired for surviving. They're wired for comfort. They're wired for, you know, instant gratification and impulse, you know, to compete and things like that. And so we can, of course, thankfully, have those survival structures of the brain, because they're important sometimes. But we can also learn how to, you know, like cool down, which is actually what the word nirvana, enlightenment, nibbana, what it really means is it's a Pali Sanskrit cooking term that means to take a boiling pot off of the stove and set it aside. So I think the Buddha is implying is not that we enlighten into some amazing state, maybe, I don't know, I haven't gotten there yet, but I think what he means is we get to cool down our survival reactions. And so, yeah, neuroscience research kind of shows, yeah, we can do that. We can train the mind. We can incline the mind. We can practice wise attention and wise intention. So that's in general some of the research about gratitude, is just the more we practice gratitude, you know, we can see, you know, experientially through our mental world the benefit of that. And there are a couple science research evidence that in particular are really interesting. One is by Barbara Fredrickson, professor of psychology at NC Chapel Hill, that looked at the importance of developing positive emotions like gratitude, joy, things like that, excitement. And she found that when we practice things like gratitude, it leads to what she calls exploratory behavior, which means you tend to do things that ordinarily you might not do. So if you're grateful for your dog, this is the example I gave last week, you might go take your dog for a walk, right? If you're practicing writing a gratitude list and you're feeling lonely and depressed, but your therapist told you to do it, and you get to your dog and you see your dog and you're like, okay, I'm going to go take my dog for a walk. And then you go see a friend at the dog park and you talk about, you know, how you've been feeling a little bit down, and you went and did something you wouldn't have done otherwise, right? So when you practice positive emotions like gratitude, they get you out of the kind of, you know, the box of our normal tactics. And another research study that I like a lot is the gratitude feedback loop, is what I call it, which is once you start practicing looking for things to be grateful for, your brain starts to look for more things to be grateful for. And the reason for this is that when you connect with gratitude, your brain releases dopamine, which is a reward chemical. So your brain says, oh, that feels good, let's do it again. And so you look again. And also dopamine makes you more likely to initiate action. So when you feel good, you're more likely to go do the things you feel good about. And there's this positive feedback loop. Sometimes for some of us, myself included, I came to this practice mostly in dire need of some sanity amidst depression. And when I noticed coming on the kind of tail end, coming out of depression, I felt this kind of gratitude feedback loop start to kick back in. And I don't know how I could have gotten there sooner. I don't think I could have, but I just recognized that I started once again seeing things I felt good about, and seeing them made me want to participate in them, and participating in them made me see more. And so I talked a little bit about this last time, mostly because I find it interesting, and I think it validates a lot of, you know, the Buddhist teaching is 2,600 years old. Right, and we're just now in our, you know, since the 80s in brain imaging and neuroscience and this whole field of contemplative neuroscience, looking at the brain and starting to understand things that people experientially developed a long time ago just by sitting and seeing what happens. I also talked last week about the near enemies of gratitude, which are unwise uses of gratitude practice. And we don't mean to do this, but we might fall in the trap of what's called the spiritual bypass, which is where we're feeling unenjoyable emotions and we push them away or avoid them to suppress or repress the emotions to try to feel good. And so, you know, what we want to do instead is we want to try to, when we feel neutral or pleasant moments in life, to just enjoy those as they come. So you're not trying to manufacture or push aside certain unpleasant things. You're trying to just delight in neutral, pleasant things that as they come up throughout the day. Because we do have this negativity bias where we tend to hyper-focus on, yeah, what is uncomfortable or what's unpleasing or what is going wrong in our lives. And so we do have moments throughout the day where things are okay, right? Or when things suck less. That was always my starting point for practicing gratitude, is not that I'm going to have this like exuberant, you know, joy for all of the wonderful things in my life, but what sucks less about my life today than it did yesterday? That's a good starting point. So we want to watch out for the spiritual bypass, where it's just kind of like we're pushing away you know, unenjoyable emotions like loneliness, sadness, fear, anger, things like that, and we're just trying to completely avoid them. We've got to tend to those things, and the practice there is to practice compassion, to practice connecting with, as the Buddha says, the words of a wise friend, to getting support, and, you know, the list goes on and on. The other thing we want to be careful about doing when practicing gratitude is what's called comparative suffering, which is where we say, well, I should be grateful because other people are worse off than I am, which isn't actually gratitude. It's based in shame, and it's a feeling that I should be, but I'm not, but I need to be because other people are worse than I am, right? Which isn't, you know, so much gratitude, but we do that, and we do these things, and no big deal, but we can start to, with mindfulness, just check in to the gratitude practice and to say, okay, am I pushing aside emotions that would maybe be better to sit with or to process with other people and to really be with those emotions? Or am I doing this comparative suffering thing where I'm saying, well, I should be grateful? And I'm not going to go over the full kind of breadth of the practice that we talked about last time. But we did have some kind of lively discussion. So if you had some things, if you were here last week and you want to talk or other things come up, take note of them. Because tonight I want to talk about a gratitude practice called sympathetic joy. As the Buddha calls it, mudita practice. And mudita means sympathetic joy, and it means the practice of actively delighting in the joy and successes of others. So it's gratitude towards others. I call it advanced Dharma practice. It seems to be, maybe I'm alone, but it seems to be one of the harder, more refined, nuanced types of practices. Compassion, I feel like I was just kind of born with that seed in me, right? I feel like I was born with the ability to care for other people's pain. I feel like I had more of the seed of, self-gratitude or, you know, loving kindness for myself. These things I can kind of find traces of. Sometimes it just totally escapes me how to delight in the joy of other people, especially difficult people in my life or people I feel competitive with. You know, and so I want to talk a little bit about the practice. I'll just say again, sympathetic joy is the practice of actively delighting in the joy and success of others. So I guess my question always is, well, why would you want to do that? And the Buddha would say, well, if you want to find welfare and happiness, we have to learn how to break down this delusion of separateness, which is one of the core things that the Buddha is, you know, talking about in his teaching, is this kind of delusion of self and other, that your happiness is yours and my happiness is mine, and I need to get my happiness and you need to go get yours. But, you know, but really instead understanding, you know, kind of on this ultimate level, that as our welfare increases collectively, my welfare increases. So your happiness, in a way, is my happiness, and vice versa. But it's hard to have that ultimate view, and it's more nuanced and tricky than that, and so I want to talk about how it could be tricky. Traditionally, the Buddha taught mudita, or sympathetic joy, to combat jealousy and envy, right? Which are, he said, two destructive emotions. And when he talks about kind of unskillful mind states or destructive emotions, things like that, it doesn't mean that they're bad, right? We don't want to judge ourselves for feeling jealous or envious. They're natural, but we want to try to root them out. And we do that with practice and by practicing sympathetic joy. So some of the reasons why we might feel jealous or envious is, I kind of going to look at three things. One is a scarcity mentality. The scarcity mentality is just the kind of sense that there's not enough joy to go around, almost as if joy was a natural resource that by you tapping into it, it's depleting a precious
resource that I would be able to tap into. The Buddha calls mudita, or sympathetic joy, one of the illimitables, or the four Brahma Viharas, one of the four heart practices. One of the ways he describes the heart practices is using the word Brahma Vihara, which means the dwelling place of God. I like to think, and some scholars think, that the Buddha used this term kind of tongue-in-cheek, because Buddhism is mostly a non-theistic spiritual practice, I would say. And so the Buddha says, well, if you want to find God, you should go to his house or her house. And where does God dwell? In loving kindness, compassion, gratitude, and equanimity, in those four qualities. So if you want to know God, know those four qualities. That's what I think the Buddha was saying about mudita. And the Buddha also called the four Brahma Viharas illimitable qualities, meaning, as he says in the Metta Sutta, that we should practice them. He says, upward to the skies, downward to the depths, outward and unbounded. So what he says is that joy is not a natural, it's a natural resource, but it's not a limited resource. So one of the things that I think gets in our way is we have this kind of, you know, very unconscious, of course, feeling or sense that someone else's joy is depleting from ours. Going along these lines, a couple other things that I think reasons why we may feel jealous or envious is because of comparison or the comparing mind. Someone else's success means something about my success. So the comparing is just this sense of measuring or scorekeeping. And, you know, sometimes we scorekeep and we're on top, and sometimes we scorekeep and we're on bottom, and sometimes we scorekeep and we're equal to. The Buddha calls all three types of these scorekeeping suffering because it has this comparing, which, again, it kind of takes us away from this ultimate truth, which is we're all here, we're all trying to find welfare and happiness. We don't always do the best in how we get that. We're all in this together, in a way. And so when we compare, we create separation. Now, we need to have discernment, which is not comparison necessarily. Discernment is just kind of understanding, okay, this person's about these things, right? This is what they value. These are, you know, we can even learn from other people. So not all comparison is going to lead to jealousy and envy, but we especially want to look out for comparison that is about our self-worth compared to another. Right, so when it comes down to kind of self-worth. And along these same lines, competition is the third. Competition is another's success means my loss of position in the tribe. So competition is a feeling of needing to belong or have likability in a group. And if you exceed or succeed in prevailing in the group, then I lose status. These are all kind of related, just things to think about. Scarcity, which is your joy, means that it depletes my joy. Comparison, which is that kind of constant scorekeeping, especially about self-worth. And then competition, which is this more kind of assertive sense of needing to position or posture ourselves above one another. I'll give you kind of an example. I don't know where it fits in with these three. I think these three all overlap, but I found out that a guy at one of the places that I work at, I contract out there, got a promotion. And I felt a feeling, I can't really describe it. It was just like a feeling of almost revulsion. It was just like kind of like wanting to push away from the conversation when I found out. And the trippy thing about this is that this guy, I like this guy a lot. He's really good at his job, and I want him to get the promotion. And I don't want the promotion. I don't want his job. Yet I still felt this kind of feeling, this weird, almost like reflex of just you know, my survival body being like, you know, why is he so good? Or what, you know, why him and not me? And the feelings of jealousy and envy can come up with people we're close to. So this was kind of, in this example, something that I noticed. Or people that are enemies. And sometimes they're harder to deal with people that we're close to. Sometimes it's harder to practice sympathetic joy for someone we're close to. And so the practice that the Buddha offered encompasses different categories of people. Practicing gratitude towards people that we love and that are easy to love. They sometimes call this the benefactor, right? Like, you know, one of the easiest sources or ways for me to tap into sympathetic joy is thinking about my little nephews, right? Like they get, my little nephew was like throwing a ball with me the other day and he's just like got a rocket for an arm. He could throw the ball clear across the room. He's 4 years old. And I was just like stunned and surprised and like proud of him. Which is a little ridiculous, but proud of him for having such a good arm. I was just like, in the moment, I was like, wow, that was awesome. And I saw him light up. He smiled. You know, and so this is like a benefactor, someone that's easy to feel that way towards. And then we practice mudita towards neutral people, which is just random encounters with people throughout the day. You know, how do we express or experience gratitude for the joys of people that we don't even know? And this can be a really powerful practice I'll talk about in a little bit. They call these the neutral people. I did mudita practice heavily for 1 year, especially in my Dharma practice. I'll tell you why, or this, you know, of coming here. And one of the categories was neutral person. I picked the person that scammed my card at the YMCA because I saw them regularly, but I didn't know anything about them, you know. And I would go in and just like, smiling like a dumbass, just like looking at this person because I'd been thinking about them and like wanting them to experience joy and happiness. And I've been sitting down like clocking hours of gratitude towards some random person. And so I would see him, but it was really amazing because I actually could feel the joy for some person just because I sat down and practiced it. It would arise, the feeling would come up. And then we, of course, practice with difficult people. You know, those people that their joys and successes are harder for us to appreciate. It's the scope of the practice. So what is sympathetic joy? I kind of want to break it down. What is it and what isn't it? And then we'll do some practice together. So the definition of sympathy that I like is it's an act or capacity of entering into or sharing the feelings or interests of another. So it's the act or capacity of entering into or sharing the feelings or interests of another. Joy is a peaceful or uplifting emotion that results when we feel connection and or delight in something, someone, some experience. So that's why I kind of put this definition together, that mudita is the practice of actively delighting in the joy and successes of others. But there's an important distinction. Yeah, you got a question?
Sorry to interrupt.
That's all good.
This is actually a question I find to be important for me. It's like, what would you say the difference between joy and happiness is?
Joy is... it's all semantics, right? These things are words. For me, joy is an emotion. So it can be a peaceful emotion if it's just kind of a neutral experience. Or it can be uplifting, like kind of have that exuberance or kind of excitement to it, that type of excitability. And happiness is more of, you know, in Buddhist practice, I like to say that happiness is a collection of good habits. So happiness is really like, you know, finding a way to practice in this world that leads to contentment, ease, and well-being.
Okay, so joy is more of a fleeting thing, and happiness, you would say, is more of like a continuous state?
Sure. Cool. In a way, yeah, in a way, for sure. And I think, you know, that we could debate those things too, and I think people do. So so feel free. So here's the distinction here. Mudita, the Buddha taught it from an ethical base, meaning that we're only practicing delighting and taking delight in the successes and joys of others that come as the result of them doing skillful deeds. So the Buddha's not encouraging us to practice delighting and enjoying the behaviors and actions of people that we don't, you know through our experience to be skillful behaviors. We're not trying to fake happiness for, you know, someone robbing someone else, or, you know, like corruption in the world, or we're not trying to have joy for, you know, the big oil companies and their profits this year necessarily, right? But rather, it's kind of a practice, and it makes it more difficult than that, which is just to try to open up and understand and to recognize the skillful deeds of others. So especially with difficult people, we tend to notice and know the unskillful, the unethical, the problematic things that people do. And mudita is really trying to help us to not ignore that, but to open to more than that, right? I like to say, got from a Dharma teacher that I really like, he says that for every one thing that's true, something else is also true. So part of the practice of mudita, or having gratitude for someone else, is to not just have this bias that, yeah, this person's all bad, all of their behaviors are wrong, all of their, you know, speech has been unskillful, all they do is cause harm. You know, we wonder, we start to try to kind of open up and see if we can find or recognize skillful deeds. Maybe this person's a family person. You know, maybe this person, you know, gives generously to charity and has helped a lot of people. Maybe this person spends time on the phone, you know, talking to their friends when they're going through a hard time. And it's, again, not to ignore the unskillful deeds, so to speak, but to open to more of the experience. So we're delighting in the skillful deeds of another. There's a two-part process. We don't have to remember or know any of this, really, but I like to think of things very methodically. And I think the first is recognize, which is you try to look for the skillful deeds. And the second part is to appreciate, which is to try to actually delight in them with the person. We start with an easy person, right? That's the first category. So I maybe think about my nephew, and I try to look for and recognize things that he does that I think will benefit his welfare, right, or the welfare of others. And I try to appreciate those in the moment and to congratulate him and to, like, share in his excitement. Some of these things can be very mundane, too. Like, they don't all have to be, like, altruistic deeds. They could be just neutral, you know, cause or effect neutral actions. And these are all, of course, very subjective, what's a good deed and what's a not good deed. But this is the practice of mindfulness, is looking in the moment to say, hey, you know, even if my friend, you know, worked really hard at, you know, playing a video game, and I know they like the video game and they finally beat the level, yeah, it's ridiculous, like that, but that's not going to hurt anyone, right? So even being able to share interests. We all, not all, some of us maybe spent time with family these holidays. And, you know, I don't always share a ton in common with my family. Some I do and some I don't. I'm not into sports, never have been. They're probably not into the same music that I'm in. But I was looking kind of for opportunities to appreciate and enjoy the interests of people around me. You know, like making small talk, I think we all could say, yeah, we don't like small talk, but small talk is maybe a gateway into something deeper sometimes. And so even just sharing interests on the surface can be a really great practice to hang with that. And I've had to learn that as a therapist too, is like really asking people to tell me more about themselves. And how beautiful it is when I actually, like, try to listen and actively engage in people's interests. What comes out. So we try to recognize, we try to appreciate. Big part of practicing gratitude for others is fake it till you make it. I took on this practice pretty strongly after a retreat where I had this awareness, or I recognized that I was very dismissive and invalidating of other people's successes. Like I shared earlier about this kind of guy that got the promotion, is I would tend to discredit or just not acknowledge or to avoid altogether, you know, people's successful experiences or, you know, good things that had happened to them. I'm just being real. It's really fucking hard practice for me. And I don't know where that came from. I think a lot of it came from a lot of competition in my friend groups growing up and not being good at sports and my friends being in sports and, you know, feeling like needing to be on top. And a lot of what I did to practice, I would just try to fake it till I made it. And I would try to make eye contact with people when they were experiencing excitement about something and they were telling me about it. And I would just try to feel their excitement. And you can, if you try to just kind of connect with someone when they're excited about something, you can feel or remember or recognize what excitement feels like. And it helped me to kind of get in the water with them. And I would start to just kind of fake, almost inauthentically sometimes, my appreciation or my gratitude or my happiness or joy for them. You know, just saying things like, that's so great, I know you worked really hard for that. You know, or being able to share kind of compliments. So, of course, there's a variety of ways that the practice can go. And when talking about things that are experiential, not so objective, like just go home, do this, do it this way, come back, report in a few days, let me know how it goes. When we talk about things that are more experiential, we really just want to start to try to be interested. And this is one of the awakening factors that the Buddha talked about, Dhamma Vichaya, which means the investigation of things. We want to really try to investigate and look. I think a requisite in a way, or a starting point for gratitude for others, is gratitude for ourselves. For me, I notice that when I feel most competitive or when I'm insecure about there being enough joy to go around, sometimes it's because I feel like my life is lacking. And if I can really focus back on what is present in my life and practice feeling the appreciation for what's available to me, I feel like it's not, I maybe recognize that it's not a scarce resource, that it's something that I have if I look for it. So sometimes my jealousy and envy comes because I don't feel or experience or connect with my gratitude for my life. I want to read a couple things. One is about our ideas on punishment. There's been some interesting research by a Dutch researcher, maybe a psychologist, I forget her name, that looks at how children learn better, behave better through positive reinforcement than negative reinforcement. Although I will say the research shows that older young adults, I think 18 to 25, respond better with negative reinforcement than positive reinforcement. Don't know why that is. But I do think it's interesting in how we look at like punishing children, or even ideas around like corporal punishment and, you know, our social justice system, or criminal justice, system. And there's a really interesting kind of excerpt from Jack Kornfield's book on the art of forgiveness, loving kindness, and peace, that he talks about this tribe in South Africa and how they deal with criminal offenses in their tribe. He says, in the Babemba tribe of South Africa, when a person acts irresponsibly or unjustly, He is placed in the center of the village, alone and unfettered. All work ceases, and every man, woman, and child in the village gathers in a large circle around the accused individual. Then each person in the tribe speaks to the accused one at a time, each recalling the good things the person in the center of the circle has done in his lifetime. Every incident, every experience that can be recalled with any detail and accuracy of the goodness this individual has done is recounted. All his positive attributes, good deeds, strengths, and kindnesses are recited carefully and at length. This tribal ceremony often lasts for several days. At the end, the tribal circle is broken, a joyous celebration takes place, and the person is symbolically and literally welcomed back into the tribe. I just can't imagine the effect of that. You're like sitting in a room with people that love you and care about you and reminding you of that in you, right? Instead of reminding us of what we already know most of the time, which is I fucked up. I misspoke, right? I didn't do what I value. I acted against, you know, what I believe. We know that a lot of the time. I love that story. And then there's another excerpt I want to read from Sam Harris's book, Waking Up. And Sam Harris, as a philosopher, naturally gets some flack. Whether you like him or not, I think, is a part of being a philosopher. But he wrote a book called Waking Up, and I really love this passage. I think it talks beautifully about what mudita is. He says, I was suddenly struck by the knowledge that I loved my friend. This shouldn't have surprised me. He was, after all, one of my best friends. However, at that age, I was not in the habit of dwelling on how much I loved the men in my life. Now I could feel that I loved him, and this feeling had ethical implications that suddenly seemed as profound as they now sound pedestrian on the page. I wanted him to be happy. What did I care if my friend was better looking or a better athlete than I was? If I could have bestowed those gifts on him, I would have. Truly wanting him to be happy made his happiness my own. That conviction came crashing down with such force that something seemed to give way inside me. My capacity for envy, for instance, the sense of being diminished by the happiness or success of another person, seemed like a symptom of mental illness that had vanished without a trace. And then came the insight that irrevocably transformed my sense of how good human life could be. I was feeling boundless love for one of my best friends, and I suddenly realized that if a stranger walked through the door at that moment, he or she would have been fully included in this love. Love was, at bottom, impersonal and deeper than any personal history could justify. The insight had the character of a geometric proof. It was as if, having glimpsed the properties of one set of parallel lines, I suddenly understood what must be common to them all. I feel like there's no better description of mudita than that excerpt for me. And so with the practice of mudita, what we do is, you know, we piece together whatever works. And this is how the heart practices are cultivated and developed through meditation. There are some commentaries a few hundred years after the Buddha's death. A person named Buddhaghosa started kind of looking at how would you develop something like gratitude? How would you develop something like sympathetic joy in meditation? And I think really geniusly so, he decided that two of the ways that we think are in pictures and words. And so we can use pictures and words to help us to connect with and to try to develop a sense of gratitude for ourselves and others. In secular mindfulness, they call this cultivating positive emotions, which is just we can practice things like gratitude. They're not just things or principles to believe in. They're things we can feel. We have felt joy. We have felt gratitude. And with practice, that feeling, that emotion can arise more frequently. Oftentimes spontaneously. And so we start with kind of words and visualization. And we'll do this tonight. We'll do a practice of working with someone easy and someone difficult. And we'll take the focus off of ourselves tonight. And we use phrases or words that help us to connect with sharing and gratitude with this person. If it's someone easy, you might just choose to say something like, "I appreciate you." And we say these silently to ourselves, breathing in and breathing out, trying to imagine this person, their face, their smile, and just saying to them silently over and over again, "I appreciate you. Thank you. I appreciate you. Thank you." Sometimes I'll use other phrases like, "May you learn to appreciate all that is good in your life." Or, "May the goodness in your life continue to grow." Or, "May you learn to hold your experience with kindness and gratitude." These types of phrases usually work better for people that are difficult because maybe you don't appreciate them. So you wouldn't want to say, "I appreciate you. Thank you." Maybe you would rather say something like, "May you learn to appreciate all that's good in your life." "May the goodness in your life," meaning the things that you do that are ethically good deeds, "continue to grow." "May you learn to hold your experience with kindness and gratitude." So these are some ways that we can practice the heart practices, is using words and images. We're not manifesting things in the material world. In the Buddhist kind of psychology, the Buddhist perspective on meditation, it's not about the material world, what's out here. It's about what's in here. So the goodness is not being bestowed on this person magically by our wish, but it's more of a, may I learn to connect with and appreciate what's good in your life, right? So I'll offer some instructions and we'll meditate together, but I want to take 3 minutes or so if you want to stretch your legs or run to the bathroom, and then we'll have plenty of time to have some discussion and questions and that type of thing afterwards.